This is Aaron Copeland. You are listening to Station WDST in Woodstock, Stereo 100, the Bulldog of the Hudson Valley.
The first question I'd like to ask you is one that I ask every musician I interview, and it often seems to have different answers. How did you first get interested in music at all?
Well, my first memories of getting interested in music is listening to my older sister and my older brother play music together in our parlor at home. And I can remember also hanging about the piano when my sister was practicing her scales, and she'd say to me, "Aaron, why are you hanging around here? Why don't you go out and play with the other kids?" Something was fascinating me. I couldn't have told you what it was then, but of course it was the sound of music.
But it got you at a very early age.
Not very early, no. 13. That's not so early.
That's true. It's not for a professional musician.
No.
When did you start playing the piano?
About that age. Maybe a little earlier. Maybe at 11, something like that.
Well, then that's curious. How did you get to be such a good pianist starting so late?
Well, that's not so late. You don't have to begin at 6.
No.
I've never given concert piano music, but I have played my own piano concerto with some of the symphony orchestras.
I heard you do it once.
Did you?
Yeah, and you made a great recording of the piano variations, which is not easy to play.
Mm-hmm.
Well, how did you do that?
I don't know. I seem able to play my own music all right, which others find really, very difficult, and I'm no good at all at Liszt and Chopin, those boys.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever try that?
Not seriously, no. It was always a bore to have to keep practicing the same piece over and over again.
How much did you practice the piano variations before you first played it?
Oh, I don't know. By the time I had written them, you see, I work at the piano, so mm-hmm. by the time I had written them, I didn't have to practice them at all.
Wow. I wish I could do that. We know something about your early training as a musician, and you did have a fairly good academic background in the United States once you got started on it, but how did you ever work up the nerve to go to Paris? Wasn't that a very unusual thing to do?
No, I don't think so. Not for an ambitious young composer living in Brooklyn. In the beginning of the 20s, that's only 60 years ago, isn't it?
That's all.
All the action, the newer things that were happening, musically speaking, seemed to be coming from Paris. You see, before the First World War, Germany was the country that all the ambitious young American composers would go to in order to continue their studies. But in 1921, when I thought of going abroad, Germany had a rather poor reputation. We had gone through the First World War, and the newer things seemed to be coming from Paris. The Group of Six got a lot of publicity in New York, and I heard that Stravinsky was living in Paris. I thought, well, Stravinsky is there, things will be happening there.
Mm-hmm. Did you meet him when you went there?
Not immediately, but I can remember the very first time I saw him in the flesh. I was walking down a street in Paris, and I saw a little short fellow approaching me, or rather approaching, and I thought, oh gosh, that's Igor Stravinsky. And he passed me by. I had no thought of talking or stopping him, you know. I found myself turning around, and I started following him. I didn't have any purpose in mind. I must have followed him for two or three blocks, and then I thought, this is silly, why am I doing this? And then I turned around and went on my way. Years later, I told him this story at his, when we were having dinner at his home in Hollywood, and we both laughed about it a lot.
How had you heard about the Boulanger?
Well, that was a stroke of extraordinary luck. I wanted to continue my studies in Paris because I had the feeling that things were happening there, that the older generation than mine had all gone to Germany to continue their studies. Mm-hmm. But Germany, we had been at war with Germany, and anyhow, we've been hearing a lot about the Group of Six in Paris, Honegger and Mio and the others. And also, I heard that Stravinsky was living in Paris. I thought, well, if Stravinsky's in Paris, things will be happening there.
Right.
So the whole combination made sense in terms of Paris. even though the older generation of American composers had almost all studied in Germany.
Was Boulanger at all known in America then? I think you were one of the first Americans to study with
him. I was. No, it says in the books that I went to Paris to study with Nigel Boulanger, which is not true. You know, once a thing like that gets printed, people copy it who write other books, and it's impossible to get it out. When I went to Paris, I never heard of Nadia Boulanger, so I couldn't possibly have gone to study with her.
So you only heard of her when you were there?
Yeah. I didn't know about anybody in the whole country of France, but I read in a musical magazine one day that the French government, as a gesture of appreciation for what the Americans had done for them in the First World War, we're establishing a summer music school in the Palace at Fontainebleau, a two-month school. Well, I thought, if I go there, I may waste 2 months, but at least I'll be with a bunch of fellow Americans, and I won't be lost in all of France all by myself. And mm-hmm. So I got to New York to join up so fast, they told me, you're the first student to join up for this school.
Mm-hmm. Was she teaching there?
Yes.
So that was how you ran into her.
Mm-hmm.
What was it like studying with her? I read accounts of her teaching that she seems to have been an extraordinary analyst, but was that all she did?
Oh, no, no. It was her, basically it was her sensitivity to music, plus a wonderfully sound and full of musical training, such as they give their students in France. You had the confidence if you showed her not a fully written piece, but just a half a page of music, that she could tell you a half dozen ways that you might go on. She wouldn't tell you how to go on, mm-hmm. but she'd suggest various possibilities, and that was very, of course, stimulating to a young student who didn't have that much experience yet as an active composer.
Who else did you meet in Paris? Did you meet any of the older generation?
Yes, I did. I met them mostly at Mademoiselle Boulanger's Wednesday afternoons. She used to have class lessons, and after that, tea was served, and the musical great came in to take part in the tea. I shook hands with Stravinsky and with Darius Milhaud and Arthur Honegger and Francis Poulenc. I mean, I was a kid from Brooklyn. I didn't know from nothing, and here I was shaking hands with all these, to me, famous names.
Mm-hmm.
So that it wasn't just the lessons that she gave, which were remarkable enough, because of her musical sensitivity, but it was the fact that her apartment and her studio was a center for musical activity in the 20s, and in the 20s, Paris was really jumping. I mean, everything had stopped during the First World War, 14 to 18. By the time I got there, in 21, it was a completely different scene. It had all come alive again.
After you went back to the United States, what was the first major piece of yours that you brought out? Was it the Organ Symphony, or was it something before that?
No, it was the Organ Symphony. There again, I have Mademoiselle Boulanger to thank for that. We read in the Paris papers that Serge Koussevitzky, who was then living in Paris and who had never been to America, had just been named the new conductor of the Boston Symphony. And Mademoiselle said, we must go and visit him.
Mm-hmm.
So we went and visited him. And by the time we were done with the visit, he said, you, pointing to me, will write a symphony for organ and orchestra, and Mademoiselle Boulanger will come to America and play the organ part. I couldn't believe my ears. You know, I had never orchestrated anything, never heard a note of my own orchestration.
Well, that sounds odd. Why did he pick that combination?
Well, on her sort of, confidence in me, he went along with it. He was anxious to, all the years that he was with the Boston Symphony as conductor, he was always anxious to introduce new composers. Not all conductors are like that.
Yes, I know that. There's a famous story about the premiere of that symphony after it was actually performed, that Damrosch made some kind of remark.
Yes.
What I've always been curious about was, what was that performance like?
The performance was perfectly adequate.
It was, huh?
Yes.
And then he said something like it.
But he felt that to his audience, that would sound like very avant-garde and modernistic music, not to be admired or even listened to. And in order to console some of the elderly ladies who were great admirers of his and steady patrons at the concerts, when the whole piece was finished and just before he started the next work, He turned around and said to the audience, if a young man at the age of 23 can write a work like you've just heard, in 5 years he'll be ready to commit murder. Well, everybody laughed. And then the headline in the papers the next day was young composer to commit murder.
But that didn't reflect his true attitude towards the piece then, huh?
Well, he took it because Mademoiselle Boulanger wanted to play it. He couldn't say, I won't play it.
But he did do a good job with it.
He did a very responsible job, yes.
What inspired the... Well, that's a hard question to ask. I'll ask it anyway. What inspired the writing of the Piano Variations? That's a piece that's always seemed like a sort of a milestone to me.
I can't say that any particular event. I must have had the idea of liking the theme that occurred to me and then doing a bunch of continuous variations on the theme.
What did it feel like to play that music? It seems very exciting to me
to
hear it.
That's nice to know. This is sometime later.
Yeah.
Well, it was exciting to play. I realized that not everybody in the audience would love it. And I used to get pretty bad write-ups, of course, in my 20s and 30s as a wild-eyed modernist.
Nevertheless, you wound up recording it, which was very unusual in those days. That was one of the first pieces of American music to be recorded.
I guess that's right. I can't remember exactly how that all happened.
It was extraordinary that it did. Recently, or relatively recently, compared with the writing of that piece, you've been quoted as saying that you liked the performances of that piece by a number of pianists, I think particularly of William Marcellos and Leo Smith, who play it quite differently than you do. Is that typical, that you like a variety of interpretations of your own music?
Well, yeah, I like them if they're justified. Not all interpretations in my mind would be justified by the music itself. Sure, it makes you feel well. The piece is not just doesn't have one single meaning that must always be the same. You like to have the feeling it has different possibilities.
I also get the impression that around this time, sometime in the 1930s, possibly even earlier, you set out not only to create a body of music which has won success, but almost an institution of there being an American music. And you've promoted the music of other composers much, much more than almost any active composer I can think of has done with his contemporaries. How did you get the idea of doing something like that, or why did you put so much effort into promoting American music as a whole instead of just your own compositions?
Well, I had always a feeling that it was no fun at all to be just a composer by yourself at home writing your great masterpieces, in your mind at any rate. I always felt the need to have some pals around, and that I had known about the group of six in France when I was there as a student. And it seemed more sensible than trying to make a place for yourself individually to do it as a group. The push would be greater and the interest would naturally be greater.
Do you feel it worked out that way?
Yes, it did. I became associated with the League of Composers also. That was a group of rather older men than I was at the time. But then later on we had other smaller organizations with the same idea in mind, but the younger composers are less well known.
Has it been stimulating for you to have that kind of contact with other composers?
Oh, yeah, sure. I never thought of, I'm a composer and I'm going to do this job all by myself. I always thought of it, especially in America, in the field of serious music, we needed a kind of group push. I imagine Edward McDowell was a rather lonely figure. I'm not sure, but that's what my guess would be. And certainly Charles Ives was very lonely.
And it did work out, too. Still, not everybody had the idea. It was your idea.
I always liked the idea of having pals around. The idea of working alone and writing great works all by myself that somebody someday would hear, that never attracted me.
You also have done an unusual amount of writing for a composer. How did that start happening?
It started because I had to make a living, which I couldn't do through the music I was writing. There wasn't enough of it, for one thing. And I found that I could earn, in one evening's talk at the New School for Social Research, more than trying to have individual students come to the studio one by one, I'd talk maybe to 100 people or later on to 200 people at the same time. And that was that meant I could earn a living by speaking for 1.5 hours once a week. It solved my economic problem very nicely.
So then you wound up turning those talks into books?
Right, yes. Mm-hmm. That was a stroke of luck, too, because I was reading, I was not reading a text. I was speaking freely from an outline of notes. Mm-hmm. And some fellow came up to me after one of my talks and said, Mr. Copeland, I don't know if you know it or not, but you're talking a book. The course was called What to Listen For in Music. Mm-hmm. And I said, how do you know? He said, well, I'm an agent of McGraw-Hill Book Company, and I know a book when I hear one. He said, I'll tell you what we'll do. I had announced I was going to repeat the course the following season. He said, we'll send a girl down here, and she'll take down verbatim what you say, and you'll see if I'm right or not. And by golly, it worked out just like that. I practically had that book. All I had to do was fix it up a bit.
How marvelous.
That's a very nice way to write a book. I recommend it to you.
You're working on one now, too, aren't you?
Yes, I am.
And how's that going?
Well, it's going slowly. It's an autobiography. I'd like to tell the story of the development of American music as I lived it. And I have a very good assistant in Vivian Perlis. I don't know if you know her name.
Oh, yes. She's worked on books on Ives.
That's right. An excellent book on Ives. She had the very bright idea of going around with a tape machine and interviewing every living person who knew Ives personally. It didn't matter who he was, whether he was the head of the composition department at Yale or whether he was the janitor downstairs. She had her tape machine and she got it all down. It makes a very original book.
And that's how you're working now with her?
Yes.
I have a question about the styles of your music. It's certainly been noted that different works of yours sound very different than each other, mm-hmm. although this isn't something that necessarily happens from one time to another. It'll happen from one piece to another, and then there may be another one that comes along right after it that sounds quite different. How did that come about in your music? Why did you write in that way?
Well, I have no clear explanation of how it turned out that way. Just all I can say is it happened naturally. There's a certain tendency if you write a highly complex orchestral work to decide you want to write something for piano that's rather less complex or draws on a different part of your musical imagination. One doesn't want to keep writing the same sort of thing over and over again.
No, I understand that. Yeah. So you approached writing each piece as a sort of a separate challenge.
Yeah, sometimes it would be the result of an actual request, a commission to produce a work. But very often it began with the actual musical ideas that occurred to me that seemed to be pregnant with possibilities.
Mm-hmm. How did you become involved in conducting for the first time? That seems to have come to you relatively late in your career.
Yes, well, if you spend as much time as I have watching other conductors, good, bad, and indifferent, conduct your own work, finally, you have the feeling, oh, I'd just like to get up there once and do it the way I dreamt it. Finally, I had the courage and I got the invitation to do that, and it was a great pleasure.
So you have obviously enjoyed conducting.
Oh, yes. Yes, it's a great sport. I recommend it to you. And the pay is good.
Yeah, sure. How much of that did you do with other people's music? I know you did some.
Some, not much.
You mentioned conducting a Tchaikovsky symphony once.
Did I? I forgot.
In Australia, I think.
Isn't that funny? That's out of my mind.
Uh-huh. You enjoy conducting, though?
Yes. I think one enjoys it if one is a composer and has watched others conduct one's work often enough. Finally, it'd be inevitable, I would think, that the composer would think, oh, I'd just love to get up there once and do it the way I dreamt it.
Mm-hmm. Koussevitzky is a big name, I guess, in the history of 20th century American music. What exactly would you say he did for American composers, and what did he do for your music?
Well, I think he was a frustrated composer. he would have loved to have been a composer. And since he apparently couldn't compose, he took the frustration out by interesting himself in the works, especially of young and still uncelebrated composers. And he was, because of that, he was, of course, an enormous help to our generation, especially. It was a feast to have your music introduced by him. You went up there and lived at Koussevitzky's house, many of us did, for a whole week, and every morning you went to rehearsal and heard them practice the piece and practice it, and he'd give advice and he'd discuss it with you. The whole week's activities of the Boston Symphony he made seem to center around the introduction of your new piece. That's a great joy to a youngish composer. And he would have loved to have been a composer. I think basically that was in the back of his mind always. If I can't do it, at least I can help younger composers along in their careers.
Yeah, he did write a little bit of music, but he doesn't seem to have been very successful
with it. No, some of it was for his own instrument, the double bass.
Uh-huh. How did he perform American music? What kind of performances did he give your pieces, for example?
Well, I can't say it was very American in quality. He was too Russian in spirit himself to be able to do that. He was a newcomer to the United States when he took the post of conductor of the Boston Symphony. But he had good rhythmic sense, mm-hmm. and as a Russian, that's not so strange.
No, not at all.
And he was passionately interested in helping the young to make a name for themselves and fully express themselves as composers.
I don't know if this question can be answered, but I'd like to have a try. Can you describe to somebody who isn't a composer what it's like to write a piece of music, how it progresses?
Well, it wouldn't be the same for all composers, of course. Each one would have their own individual way of turning things out. I would say you can't begin writing music just because you have the idea that you'd like to. It has to take some actual shape or sound in your own mind, or if you're a pianist, you might hit on it while you're doodling around at the piano. It has to take some actual form and content. And then if you're not a trained composer, you really don't know what to do with it, because you don't never or would rarely improvise an entire piece. You'd get an idea, four pieces or several ideas, and then you depend on your training and background to tell you what the possibilities are with that material.
Would you say that's a fair description of how you've written your own pieces?
Yes.
Yeah. That is interesting. I'm glad I asked.
What's interesting about it? I should think it would be just fundamental. How else could you do it?
Well, see, if we haven't been trained as composers, we wouldn't know at all.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, well, I've been asked that sometimes. How do composers write music? And I can't answer because I'm not one.
Well, I don't think two composers necessarily would ever write, approach the job in quite the same way.
Right.
I would say that most composers depend on getting at the very start pregnant ideas. That is to say, ideas which do not seem complete in themselves, but seem able to be developed in an interesting way. And then, having found one or two of those, you look for other contrasting ideas that are different from the ones that occur to you in that way. If you're a trained composer, it helps. You can sort of, if you must, force yourself for a specific job, but if you're perfectly free and are not in a hurry, it may take you several months to write a fully complete orchestral work.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you can think of that you would have liked to do in your career that you never got to?
Mm-hmm. Well, it would have been nice to have written a grand opera for production at the Met.
Uh-huh.
I wrote an opera. It's not grand. It's a more lyrical opera, not so ambitious as a big-time opera at the Met. But it's a tough job. It's very difficult to find a librettist who you'd be completely happy with and would find a subject that you'd be completely happy with. Most of the fellows who, and girls nowadays you have to add, who write operas, they're sort of stuck with it. I mean, that's the only thing they really want to do, because there's so many things that might discourage you otherwise if you could do other things.
Anything funny ever happened to you associated with music?
Funny?
Funny. Funny, strange
things. Ha ha, funny ha ha?
I guess.
Oh, you mean a strange thing. Gee, nothing immediately jumps to mind. Of course, I thought it was rather funny, though that's not the word, that I should have decided to study with a lady composition teacher in Paris, France. When I went there, I didn't know I was going to be working with Nadia Boulanger, you see. Though in the books, I noticed, they started saying that I went to Paris to study with Nadia Boulanger. So that was I had to be very brave to decide to work with a woman when I couldn't think in the whole history of music of any famous composer who had studied composition with a lady.
That never occurred to me, but for your generation, that was the truth, wasn't it?
Yes. There probably are exceptions, but ones we wouldn't even know about.
Something you wrote about being a professional composer reminded me of a talk I had once with the cellist Janos Starker, who said he considers himself to be very much a professional cellist. And he said to him that means being enough in command of his art to be able to give at least 85% to 90% of his best on any occasion. Mm-hmm. He said then the rest comes. How does that strike you?
Well, it strikes me that he's a very lucky fellow. I don't I don't think that a composer could hope for 80% or 90% success on everything that he tries to do. But composers vary greatly in their facility or lack of facility, or it really doesn't matter how you make it as long as you get a good result.
You never seem to have gone in much for the romantic notion of a composer drawing inspiration out of the ether. You do seem to have a more professional attitude than that.
Well, I always found I could write most easily if I based my writing on actual musical ideas that occurred to me out of the blue, which you can't sit down and say, now I'm going to get a musical idea. I mean, you could, but it wouldn't be very successful, I don't think. But if an idea hits you and you think, oh, gee, I could do something with this, that's enough to get you started if you're really a born composer.
I have one more question. What does it feel like to be sitting up here in the woods and looking out at the lovely view and to realize that your music is being played and probably will be played forever all over the world?
You are a very optimistic gentleman, but I certainly hope you're right.
Well, let's say I am right. What do you think of that?
I think it's delightful.
I think that's a delightful answer. Well, I'd like to thank you very much for talking with me. We'll be looking forward greatly to seeing you down at SUNY New Paltz at the concert.
Good.
And thanks for sharing your thoughts and time with us.
Well, thank you for coming around.
Oh, my great pleasure.